ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. When you clock on for work each day, is the boss you? If so, does it feel like it's all getting harder? The number of people willing to take a risk and start their own business fell to an all-time low in 2025, according to new figures. What does this mean for the future of mum and dad's small business? That's in the next 20 minutes. Also ahead, have you found yourself giggling to videos starring world leaders as Lego figurines or interspersed into Top Gun? The wars of the 20th century and further back had propaganda. In 2026, thanks to AI, we have slopaganda. That's what the scholars are calling it anyway. Could you fall for it? It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, a few years ago, did you suddenly notice a low hum in your neighbourhood? The din of tiny wings beating the air. Maybe the flowers became brighter on your verges, or you got more fruit off your fruit trees, all because of the backyard bee explosion. There's been a steady increase in the number of amateur beekeepers setting up hives of European honeybees as a hobby. But in recent years, many professional and amateur beekeepers have had the heartbreaking experience of having their hives destroyed thanks to an outbreak of a tiny parasite called varroa mite. It's almost impossible to contain. So now it's here in Australia and the bees are dying. What is the future of the plants who rely on them and the industry and hobbyists who love them like family? If you're a backyard beekeeper, I would love you to tell me about it. What got you into it? What do you get out of it? And how are you dealing with varroa mite? With me is Mike Allerton, the Vice President and Biosecurity Officer at Amateur Beekeepers Australia. Mike, welcome to Life Matters.
Hi, Tegan. Thanks for having me here.
Can you tell me how many amateur beekeepers we think there are in Australia?
Oh, there's about 46,000 or so registered out of about 48,000 to 49,000 beekeepers all up. So by and large, the bigger community is amateur beekeepers, backyard beekeepers, but the commercial guys have most of the hives.
Right. That sounds like a lot to me. Is that a lot more than there was a few years ago?
It has been steadily increasing. Mind you, when varroa hit us, even in just the ABA, Amateur Beekeepers Australia numbers, we were 5,000 members strong. And when varroa hit, we dropped to not much more than 3,000. Mm. And now we're steadily increasing to around the 4,000 and growing.
If you are an amateur beekeeper or if you know about beekeeping, you definitely know what varroa mite is. If you're not, you might be scratching your head a little bit. Can you tell me a bit about what this parasite is?
Right. So this is a parasite that came out of the Asian side of the world, and it migrated over to the European honeybee quite a while ago. And it's a parasite that exclusively feeds on bees. And during its a bee's adult life, it feeds on the bee's equivalent to their liver called the fat body. And when the developing mites in the bee's cell, when they pupate, they feed on the hemolymph, which is like the blood. Without bees, the mites die, and it takes about 5 days, and then the mites starve.
But with the mites, the bees suffer. What has it meant for your hives, Mike?
Oh, when it hit my area in Hawkesbury year before last, it was the huge wave that comes through is devastating. And overseas, they said your hives will last 3 to 5 years before they collapse because we don't have the viruses. But Australia is the first country, other than Africa, to have small hive beetle before varroa arrived. And that combination of small hive beetle and varroa is what caused our demise. The bees just collapsed within weeks instead of that months or years. And all of my hives perished last year in that rapid. The varroa weakened them and the small hive beetle swept in and just overwhelmed them in absolutely hideous times. It was so fast.
And this is something that you do for the love of it. What was it like for you to have to see your hives destroyed?
Well, like a lot of backyard beekeepers, I viewed my bees as family members. You mentioned that earlier. And a lot of beekeepers treat their bees as their kids. So it was devastating. It was really hard to take. But worse than that was during the eradication phase. And I volunteered to take part in that with the hope that it would work. And the number of beekeepers that had to see their hives destroyed in front of them, even though at the time they didn't have any mites, that was really devastating for a lot. And there were people on the commercial side and the amateur side that were pretty much on suicide watch for quite a while there. It was just absolutely depressing and devastating.
Yeah, that's huge. You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking to Mike Allerton, who's the Vice President and Biosecurity Officer at the Amateur Beekeepers Australia organisation. We're talking about varroa mite, but we're also talking about the impact of something like this on a hobby that so many people love, tens of thousands of registered amateur beekeepers in Australia. If you're one of them, I'd love to know how you're dealing with varroa mite and with the threat to the thing that you love to do. Also with me is Professor Sasha Mikhev, who's an evolutionary biologist at the Australian National University, who's also part of the Australian Bee Observation Network with a particular focus on varroa mites. Sasha, welcome.
Good morning.
We were the last country to be varroa mite free. How did we manage to stave it off for so long?
Technically, there are still some small island nations that are varroa-free, and that gives a bit of an insight as to how we got so lucky. Mm-hmm. We're not connected to anybody, so our biosecurity has kept varroa off our shores for quite a number of years. But you only need one failure for this kind of parasite to take hold, and unfortunately, our luck ran out.
What sort of impact has it had on bee colonies around Australia, Sasha?
Well, we're just in the beginning phase of varroa spread, but we can already get some insights into what's happening and what is going on. So in 2004 and 2005, there have been surveys funded by a transition to management plan of losses of beekeepers, both commercial and amateur, across Australia. And we're definitely seeing an increase in colony losses where varroa has taken place in both contexts. So this has caused massive mortality in parts of New South Wales that have been affected. And varroa is just spreading from there. You know, in the past year, it's gone out of New South Wales to Victoria and Queensland. And given how quickly it spreads, I think much of Australia is going to have varroa in the next several years.
Bees, we're talking about it very much as a hobby today, but bees are such an important part of our ecosystem. They play a really important role in crop pollination. Do we know if those knock-on effects are being felt yet?
Well, there is very little data on what's happening with feral bees or bees that have escaped our management and now live in the bush. We do know that Australia has one of the highest densities of feral bees, and they provide a wide range of both services both to the environment and to agriculture. There are many many crops that are pollinated by these feral bees. And these populations are also likely collapsing, though they're hard to survey and it's hard to get exact data. But elsewhere in the world, people have recorded collapses of over 95%. So there are changes happening in the bush, a little bit out of sight. And that is affecting pollination because the wild bees, the feral bees that live in the forest, they do pollinate some crops, and that's creating additional pressures on availability of honeybee colonies for pollination.
Mike, what have you seen in your area around the perhaps decline in the number of honeybees and what the effects might be on those crops there?
Well, it has been very noticeable in the last two seasons. The season before last, we were getting, like the local clubs, were getting calls from small agricultural producers, the market gardens, because their crops just weren't striking. They weren't getting pollinated. And then in this last season, it's even worse. Completely failed crops. And up in Bilpin, which is orchard country, apples and so on, they failed to strike as well. And one of the orchardist brought in hives for the first time, managed hives to pollinate. But Unfortunately, they're right on the edge of a eucalyptus forest, and bees will go to a flowering eucalyptus tree over an apple tree any day. So they'll fly up to 5 kilometres to collect nectar and pollen. And if there's a decent forest within a few hundred metres of them, they'll go there instead. So failed crops already.
Interesting, because of the competition between what the bees want to feed on. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor chatting to Mike Allerton, who's the Vice President and Biosecurity Officer at Amateur Beekeepers Australia, and Professor Sasha Mikhev, who's an evolutionary biologist at the Australian National University and part of the Australian Bee Observation Network, talking about the impact of a newly arrived parasite, varroa mite, on bees in Australia, but also on beekeepers, amateur beekeepers. It's such a popular hobby. Maybe it's your hobby. Coco says, I'm an amateur beekeeper in the Northern Rivers. I had a similar experience last year. I lost my 2 hives in a matter of a couple of weeks, which was devastating. And I really went through a feeling of grief. I love my bees. Coco says, I'm a huge honey lover and supply my friends and family. My garden also immediately felt the absence of bees. It's a really scary time at a moment when we really need our bees. Caro says, the lack of bees in my garden this year is awful. No busy hum, no cross-pollination, I assume. What have other countries done or experienced in recovery of honeybees, and how long will it be? And Caro adds, the blue-banded bees seem to be more prolific this year. Less competition? Sasha, what do we know about what other countries have done and what the less competition might mean for native bees like the blue-banded bees?
Well, that's a great question. So I'll break it up into two parts. One is what the other countries have done, because clearly, you know, varroa has been around for decades around the world, and we still have honeybees everywhere. So in terms of dealing with varroa, in essence, you have to continuously monitor and manage it. It becomes kind of like a chronic infection or disease that you have to keep treating with a variety of ways, either chemical or different kinds of other methods of keeping the mites down. So if you have colonies in Australia, that's just going to be part of your regular cycle. A couple of times a year, you'll be treating for varroa, and that will keep the hives healthier. In terms of what's going to happen with native pollinators and to the extent to which they will replace honeybees in different contexts is more complex, because in Australia, you know, we have very different pollinators than the rest of the world. So the most honest answer is probably time will tell. In principle, we should see an increase, but will they fully replace honeybees in our gardens or the bush? We don't know. Definitely in the agricultural context, we'll probably need to rely on honeybees for the foreseeable future, because a lot of our agriculture, you know, pretty much all of our fruits, nuts, and berries, they're set up to rely on honeybee pollination, and there is no easy way around that. So commercial operators will have to also treat their hives to make sure that they have colonies available for pollination.
So, Sasha, we heard the stats before from Mike on just how many amateur beekeepers there are across Australia. The number of hives are concentrated in the commercial operations, but the numbers of beekeepers is very much skewed towards amateur beekeepers. Has that popularity maybe played a role in spreading varroa mite? Not to cast aspersions on amateurs, but, you know, it's a more fragmented group of people. Perhaps there's less close monitoring than a commercial operation?
If anything, I would actually probably say the commercial operations transmit varroa more effectively, because the nature of commercial beekeeping involves moving bees across vast distances to chase honey flows. And that's in some ways the best way of spreading varroa. Because by itself, varroa is limited to how far a bee can fly. Well, that's not nearly as far as a diesel truck can move a hive.
Mm. Mike, there's a question here from, there's a comment here from Margaret from Canberra saying, in recent years, people have been encouraged to think that home beekeeping is easier than it really is. Margaret says, amateur beekeeping is quite expensive. It shouldn't be undertaken without proper training and guidance. If poorly managed, bees will struggle or swarms will leave and enlarge the problematic feral population and spread diseases to other hives. What do you say to that? Has it been a bit of a wake-up call for people who were just thinking maybe it would be a cute little weekend hobby?
I totally agree with her comment. There's been a lot of people get into beekeepers, and it's a bit like the puppy for Christmas, and it's too much work and they abandon. And that's unfortunate because an unmanaged hive can become the next disease bank and pest or disease, Varroa now, but American foul brood is still a massive problem throughout Australia. And unmanaged hives become those AFB and mite bombs. So they definitely need training. I recommend anyone going into beekeeping, before you get your hive, go to the local club and show up there every month for a few months and learn how to do it and see if it's for you before you get your hives. And then when you're confident and you've had some training in the field days, you're on the best foot forward to do a successful beekeeping hobby.
It's Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor with Mike Allerton at Amateur Beekeepers Australia and Professor Sasha Mikhev from ANU and part of the Australian Bee Observation Network. We're talking about amateur beekeeping. We're talking about Varroa mite. If it's not something that you have participated in, you might be scratching your head a little bit, but if you have a friend who gifts you jars of honey from their home beehive, that friend is worried about this mite right now. And if it's something that you've had experience with, I'd love to hear how you're dealing with it. Now, we have been talking very much about European honeybees in this conversation so far, but a lot of people on the text line want to talk about native bees. One person says, several years ago, I considered backyard beekeeping of European honeybees. Varroa mite outbreaks overseas convinced me it wasn't worth it as an amateur. I decided to invest in Australian stingless native bees, which are unaffected by Varroa mite. Their range is 500 metres from their hive. More research is needed to determine if they can help with pollination. Another text says, I'm an ecologist and want to point out that European honeybees are not important in native ecosystems. In fact, they have various negative effects on them. It's rarely spoken about because bees are so important to our food crops. Sasha, where's the right balance between giving native bees their best shot and European honeybees as part of our agricultural system?
Well, I think it depends on the context. So I do think that the native pollinators can have roles in smaller orchards and for different kinds of crops. If we're thinking about large crops that are grown in huge monoculture orchards, so let's imagine almonds, for example. So they are vast areas where you really have just one crop. And for much of the year, it's an ecological desert. There's not a lot of forage there for any kind of pollinator. And during the couple of weeks that the almond flowers are on, you need to have a vast density of pollinators to make sure that there is going to be seed set. In that context, honeybees, European honeybees, are what we use right now. One can imagine a system that gradually transitions into other kinds of pollinators, but that is going to require kind of time investment and proof of concept. It's not something that's easy to change after decades of established practice.
So, Sasha, if someone is an amateur beekeeper of European honeybees, what sorts of things can they be doing to prepare for Varroa mite if they're not already impacted?
One of the things that's really worth doing is starting to read some literature about Varroa management, how to count Varroa, what kind of treatments are available. And there's lots of documentation, both in Australia and internationally, about how to do that. If you have friends who live in Varroa-infested areas, a great opportunity is to come and visit and see what this actually is like and maybe help them treat their hive or do a mite count just so it becomes a little bit less abstract. I don't think it necessarily has to be a panic. It really can be done with education and preparedness. You know, as I pointed out, Varroa hasn't stopped amateur beekeeping in the rest of the world. People have just adjusted to it.
Mike, you're representing the amateur beekeepers here. You've lost your hives. You talked about what a devastating impact that was, but you're still in the space. What's kept you coming back?
Well, I call myself an obsessed beekeeper, so nothing will stop me doing beekeeping. And it's the one pastime that I know of that no one in the world can possibly know everything there is to know about them. Because researchers like Sasha and scientists across the planet are doing amazing discovery science every day, and they're coming up with new information all the time. So no one can know it all. And what else can you do that has that vast knowledge increase all the time? And a note on how it's going at the moment. Anyone getting into beekeeping now doesn't know any different than life with varroa. So it's situation normal for them. And that's what I'm seeing with our increasing membership, like increased over 1,000 new members in the last year and a half or so. Those people, the ones in varroa country, don't know any different.
So you think that's a good thing? They're coming in having to know these skills from the outset.
That's right. It's just a normal part of learning beekeeping now.
Well, Mike, Sasha, thank you both so much for joining me. Mike Allerton is the Vice President and Biosecurity Officer at Amateur Beekeepers Australia. Professor Sasha Mikhev is an evolutionary biologist at the Australian National University and part of the Australian Bee Observation Network. And thank you for sharing your thoughts with me on varroa and beekeeping in general today. Linny from Catherine Hill Bay, south of Newcastle, has texted in because that was ground zero for varroa. Linny says, I'm a beekeeper and I'm so pleased to say I managed to keep my bees going right through the varroa season. They're going incredibly well, too strong in fact, Linny says. I put the treatment strips in and managed them properly following the advice from my bee mentor and now I've got the strongest hives. Both hives are sitting here thriving, producing lots of honey and doing a wonderful job pollinating all my vegetables. With the right advice, the solutions are often right under our noses at your local bee store. It's actually a really simple solution and the guidance is out there. You just need to go and find it. Spike says, it's very tough times in northern New South Wales. I've lost many colonies while doing all I can to help my bees cope with this parasite. It's had a massive impact on my small business, keeping bees and helping others in the region maintain their colonies too. I'm noticing the lack of bees in nature. It's very obvious. Many ups and downs over the last 6 months. Trying to focus on the little wins. We'll stick around here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National because coming up next, propaganda is nothing new. Maybe it's red and blue Soviet era posters or speeches in ancient Greece, but it looks a little different in this era of AI slop.
Hello, it's Lisa Leong from This Working Life, helping to make your work life better with advice from the world's top experts, like psychotherapist Esther Perel.
Many conflicts are about power. Power is when I dismiss what you're bringing up. Power is when I magnify a problem.
And Professor Adam Grant.
We need to take our critics and our cheerleaders and turn them into coaches.
Free coaching! This Working Life on ABC Radio National and anytime on ABC Listen.
It's never been quicker or easier to generate content to suit whatever message you're selling and make it look innocuous, just like any other crazy video that may or may not be real online. So what if your message is political propaganda? Since the US and Israel's war on Iran, we've seen this in hyperdrive. There's been videos showing Lego depictions of world leaders, official footage from the White House spliced with scenes from Top Gun. And there is a new word for this deeply online phenomenon, slopaganda. The videos are obviously fake. So is slopaganda meaningless? It feels different to the kind of wartime propaganda you might have learnt about in history class. So why is it flooding your feed? Who wins if you end up giggling at videos of a Lego Donald Trump? Well, you're about to hear from one of the people who coined the phrase, but I want to know if you've found it harder to recognise propaganda, if you've seen a rise of this in your social media feed since the start of the war. With me is Mark Alfano, Associate Professor in Philosophy at Macquarie University. Mark, welcome to Life Matters.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
So tell me about this new word that you've coined, slopaganda.
it's a bit cheeky, but the idea is to combine propaganda with this more recent term, slop. Slop is supposed to be unwanted generative AI content. So anything that, for instance, a large language model might put out in terms of text or audio or video. And this has become quite prevalent in the last couple of years as these tools have become more powerful and also extremely cheap and easy to use.
So this isn't just a word that you've come up with just for the fun of it. You've worked with some collaborators in your academic life. You've made an academic research paper sort of describing this phenomenon. What were you seeing that made you go, oh, we need to write about this?
Yeah, so I've been working on misinformation and disinformation and propaganda in my philosophical research for over a decade now. And the thing that has struck me in the last 2 years or so is the speed and scale and scope that these new tools make possible. So during World War I, for instance, the Australian government produced war-related propaganda showing the Kaiser reaching out to annex Australia. That poster probably took at least 2 months to produce and distribute. Now, if something happens, any person with an internet connection can produce slopaganda that reaches a million or several million people within 30 minutes. So it's just a different scale and scope that we haven't really seen before.
And even faster than what we might have seen just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so notoriously, there was a group in St. Petersburg that propagandized the U.S. population during the 2016 presidential election. But they were working from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. And they didn't have a deep knowledge of U.S. culture. It seems like they probably had no effect whatsoever, even though they were working full time. Now, with the possibility for anyone to do this and to have it enhanced by artificial intelligence, we're entering a brave new world.
If you're saying, so they were like troll farms, that's what they were calling them back in 2016, which is another fantastic turn of phrase. If you're saying that they didn't really have an impact, then why are you worried about slopaganda, which is so obviously, no one's mistaking these for genuine videos, surely?
Well, I think that's maybe a little bit too optimistic, to be honest with you. So nobody thinks that Donald Trump is a Lego figurine. So the propaganda that's using that kind of content and that sort of depiction is not fooling anyone. But it's also possible to use AI to create deep fakes. So, for instance, Chris Cuomo fell for a deep fake of the U.S. politician AOC. It was a video that made it look like she was giving a speech that would be very embarrassing for her if she had actually given that speech in Congress. And he shared it with millions of people. And when she pointed out that that was fake, he said, well, but it kind of sounds like you. So I think we have to worry about both the cases where people are taken in and mistake generative AI content for authentic content, and also cases where people think that something that actually is authentic is produced by AI, because that just destroys trust in the news.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, chatting with Mark Alfano, who's an associate professor in philosophy at Macquarie University, about a new term that he and his collaborators have coined, slopaganda, i.e. propaganda in this age of AI slop in which we live. I'd love to know if you're seeing it in your feed, how you kind of pass that for yourself when you're looking at it. If you think maybe it's influencing you, that might be something hard for you to know for yourself. Mark, there's an interesting comment on the text line from Dr. Tim Cadman from Griffith University, because we have a very erudite listenership here at Life Matters. He says, it's important to understand that propaganda can sometimes be factual. That's how campaigns in war are won, persuading the public. But by definition, slopaganda can't be true because it's machine-generated based on slop. What do you reckon about that?
Yeah, I think that's right. So propaganda doesn't have to be false. It has to be manipulative. And you can manipulate people both with lies and with truths. Because slopaganda doesn't actually represent anything, it's in a way neither true nor false. But that doesn't mean that it can't influence people's emotions, their attention, their values, their dispositions to engage in political activity. So it can still be harmful even if it's not strictly speaking, false.
What sorts of messages or moods are you most concerned about when you're looking at the videos that you're seeing online at the moment?
The stuff that gets the most attention is things that are emotionally engaging, especially things that evoke negative emotions like contempt or disgust or anger or hatred. And given that Slopaganda can be micro-targeted based on someone's digital footprint, their search history, their emails, their purchasing on Amazon, essentially anything that can be measured about them, it's possible to figure out a profile for someone and give them micro-targeted Slopaganda that is for them and people who are very similar to them. So, for instance, a couple of years ago during the 2024 U.S. presidential campaign, people who were supporters of Israel were targeted with political advertising that on Twitter that that was keyed to anti-Palestinian sentiment, while people who were supporters of Palestine were given propaganda political ads that were anti-Zionist. And that was by the same company. Mm. So what seems to engage people is things that upset them. And in this current era, it's very easy to figure out what will upset someone and then feed them that kind of ad based on current events.
It's funny, the word slop, I feel like, is a bit of a misnomer because it sounds like it's something that you would never value. But what I'm hearing from you is it's actually so finely tuned that it can slip between your defenses without you realizing.
Yeah, I mean, so the guy who coined the term slop 2 years ago, year and a half ago, he wanted to compare it to spam. So spam is unwanted email. And his idea was that slop is unwanted generative AI content. But then the question is how close the analogy is. So almost no one actually likes spam. There's a almost universal consensus that we don't want spam. But there are people who, when they get AI slop, they're more than happy to consume it. So, you know, think about like the difference between someone who says, you know, send me another Nigerian prince scam versus someone who is interested in consuming lots of AI slop. It's just, it's not a perfect analogy. And then the question is like, okay, well, but it's unwanted, but who doesn't want it? Is it the person who's consuming it? Is it the person who's producing it? Is it the regulatory agencies? Is it government? This is a really difficult question to answer.
So it's a concern because it's potentially manipulating us. There's a huge volume of it, which means it's hard to get away from it. And it's potentially very, very finely tuned to our own interests and weaknesses. In your paper, you outline three interventions to combat Slopaganda. What kind of things are you recommending?
Yeah, so I think we need to have a sort of multi-prong approach to this. So at the level of the individual, things like digital literacy are going to become even more important than they already are. Just being able to recognize this stuff for what it is and therefore not be influenced by it is going to be really important. there's also individual interventions that focus on what in philosophy we call things like intellectual humility. I've studied this for years now, and it turns out that people who are more intellectually humble are able to resist this kind of manipulation better than those who are less humble. In addition, I think it's not fair to put the responsibility solely on the individual. So I think that regulation needs to come in and start doing things like watermarking generative AI content, so it's really obvious that you're seeing AI rather than something authentic. Mm. And then at the level of economics and society, I think that we need to be aware of the fact that it's only a couple of companies, just a handful, that control the global supply of the tools that make this possible. And whenever you have a monopoly or a near monopoly of this sort, bad things happen for society. So that suggests to me, at least, that we need better regulation of these companies, possibly breaking them up or turning them into public-private partnerships.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for sharing your insights. Malc Alfano is Associate Professor in Philosophy at Macquarie University. Stick around. Coming up next here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, is the era of small business facing its demise?
They shall grow not old.
Join us to commemorate Anzac Day across the ABC.
Age shall not weary them.
From coverage of the dawn service and march in your capital city, to the services at Gallipoli and Villers-Bretonneux.
At the going down of the sun and in the morning.
Anzac Day 2026.
We will remember them.
On ABC TV, iView and online, on ABC Listen and here on ABC Radio National.
Did you ever do the lemonade stand thing as a kid? Or letter drop box the whole neighbourhood advertising your lawn mowing services? Whatever your level of innate entrepreneurialness, the dream can look a little different to the reality as an adult. If you are one of the millions of Australians who run a small business, chances are you are feeling the pinch at the moment. There's the overwhelming burden of admin and compliance, the cash you need just to get it off the ground, and the existential dread of what if it fails? A new report from the Committee for the Economic Development of Australia has found the proportion of business owners as a share of the workforce fell to an all-time low in 2025. And when the odds are stacked this high against you, the question is less, why are people walking away, and more, why would you bother trying? If you're a business owner who's nodding furiously, I'd love to hear from you. What are the biggest challenges you faced? How have you managed to grow despite them? Or maybe you're someone who decided it was time to walk away. With me is Melinda Salento, who's the CEO of the Committee for the Economic Development of Australia, or CEDA, which authored this report. Melinda, welcome to Life Matters.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So top line, what's the report found about trends of new business creation and business ownership?
Yeah, well, you stole my punchline at the outset, but but what the report found was that the percentage of, or the share of business owners in the workforce has dropped to a record low, and the rate of creation of new businesses that employ people is at a two-decade low. Now, these are trends that we think are actually pretty concerning, because it's these new startup businesses that bring innovation and new ideas, new products and services into the economy. They're a real, you know, spark of dynamism. And of course, they create new jobs.
And people still want to own their own businesses. They're just not able to.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, we found the aspiration to start your own business amongst adults is as high as it's ever been. And interestingly, when you ask high school kids whether they want to start a business at some point in their career, almost 50% say yes. Mm-hmm. So the aspiration is still there, yet we see a trend decline across all sectors and all age groups in new businesses starting up. So we think it's a structural problem there, and a bit of a mismatch between aspiration and actual outcomes.
So what are the barriers?
Look, I think there's quite a few things that we've identified in the report. You spoke to them at the outset, and any business person, and certainly any small business person you talk to these days, is going to talk about the burden of regulatory and tax compliance in particular. There is actually a lot of support out there for business startups, but it can be hard to find, and it's can be hard to navigate. We think they, of course, have got to keep an eye on the issues in the broader economy and the extent to which they enable competition and the startup of new businesses, and then access to finance, which I suspect there's quite a few wannabe startups or small businesses out there who'd be nodding as I say that as well.
Well, also with us here is David Ridden, who runs his own craft distillery on the Gold Coast. David, you've had a number of small businesses over the years. Is this ringing true for you?
Yeah, absolutely, for sure. I think that, there's no doubt. You know, I've been 37 years working for myself this year, different businesses, but definitely in the last, you know, 3 to 4 years, we've seen this real shift to, you know, really over compliance, you know, much more difficulty to run a business. And, you know, and the challenge is that, you know, if you've got a business that's doing $1 million a year and one that's doing 10 million, your compliance costs are the same. So there's just, you know, way too many compliance challenges now for small business, and that's making it really, really difficult to concentrate and focus on what you want to do, and that's, you know, grow your business, look for sales, look for new revenue.
So there's that scale problem. That's what you're sort of saying. The costs are the same to a point, no matter what your size of your business is. What other challenges are really grating for you at the moment, David?
I think one of the, you know, I pulled some numbers from our business for the calendar year 2025 and just said, look, what are my top 10, you know, who do I spend the most money with, and what are they? Who are they? And so I just pulled out our top 10 people that we spend money with. And the craziest thing is, by far the top line was the ATO. More than 3 times more we've got to spend on anything else in our business. And the second line, number two, was staff costs, people costs. And so everything else, all the other inputs to our business were far, far lower than those two top lines.
Is that different to what it used to be?
It didn't used to be as great, for sure, from an ATO point of view. You know, I mean, it was always in your sort of top three of who you're spending money with every year, but it's grown, you know, phenomenally grown in the last, you know, sort of decade. So now you know, you look at those two things as a business owner, you go, well, gee, the two big most people I pay are people who work for me and the government. And I think if you asked most small business owners in Australia, they would have pretty much everyone who works for them would be earning more than them. Yeah. And the way of wages every week, for sure.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to David Ridden, founder and CEO of Grandad Jack's Craft Distillery on the Gold Coast, and Melinda Salento, who's the CEO of the Committee for the Economic Development of Australia, the group behind this new report showing that small business ownership in Australia has reached an all-time low last year. I'm asking you for your stories of being a small business owner, how that's going for you. Is it harder than it used to be? You are blowing up my text line. Anna from Brigalong says, part-time home-based dog groomer, biggest challenge, rise in insurance costs, 33% last year when CPI is in single digits. Sharon says, I believe small business will diminish. We have monopolies and duopolies. We live in a shareholder investor capitalist economy. Investing not working is the new way. It's alarming. Training, innovation and quality employment is the consequence. Melinda, what should we be doing differently if we want to protect small businesses? You said before they're a really important part of our economy.
Yeah, well, firstly, can I just say, gosh, yeah, the callers phoning in and David's comments really resonate and really underscore the findings of our report. If I could just say on the insurance piece, that's something that's really coming up too, and there is actually a parliamentary inquiry into insurance for small business at the moment, which we'll be keeping an eye on, because along with access to finance, that's a real issue. What do we need to do differently? Obviously, we need to look at the regulatory burden. It's an issue across the country, and we've been talking about the need to spark innovation and drive productivity for a long time, and we're not seeing that shift. And we've just seen this regulatory burden creep up and creep up and creep up, and it really impacts small businesses. As David said, they can't afford to spend the time on that. And I'll give you one example too of the sort of thing that we need to keep tabs on. You know, the BAS statements that small business need to file, the threshold for that when you have to start filing at 75,000 hasn't changed since 2000. So in more than 25 years, and I'm guessing that prices have changed a heck of a lot, and what you earn has changed a heck of a lot since then. So I think that's really important. We have to look at finance. So many small business owners rely on equity in their home to borrow against. You know, as home ownership has declined and people are taking on more debt for their homes, that's limiting or potentially limiting finance. So we've got to look at other forms of finance and make sure that we've got the venture capital funding available and potentially other forms of finance. The issue of competition is something that the ACCC is obviously continuing to look at. But if I go back to the compliance costs, like if you're doing business with a bigger business as well, you know, how prepared are they and able to engage with you, and those compliance costs filter down. And I guess the final thing I'd say is when you've got a bunch of, you know, almost 50% of school kids thinking about starting up a business, we also need to make sure that kids coming out of school have the skills that can help them to start up a business, but also for adults as well, that they're getting the skills and knowledge that would help them to act on their aspirations to start up a business.
Melinda, it's really interesting you mentioned the thing about debt and home ownership. On the text line, one story: I worked for a small business and my former boss, the principal owner, was hoping to retire in the next 5 to 10 years. He was really disappointed that none of the current employees were interested in investing and becoming part owners. He took it quite personally, and I had a really frank discussion with him about the cost of living. We're all under 50 years old, and personally, I have a massive HEX help debt and am a renter. To invest in a business, even one I really care about, seems a bit ludicrous when I have so much debt and no home of my own, which really speaks to a lot of the points you were making there.
Yeah, and if you look at what's happening with business startups across the different age groups, where you see the sharpest decline is actually in those years when you know people are facing some of the biggest cost pressures, and particularly if they own a home in that sort of mid-30s to mid-40s. I think the other thing that's really interesting, if you take a step back and think about the kind of support that's out there at the moment, if you're a younger person, like there's a lot of talk about first homeowner support, but there's actually not much visibility around the support that might be available to start a business. So I think even in the conversations that we're having, you know, around what your aspiration should be, it's still obviously tilting very heavily towards housing as the sort of cornerstone of lifetime security, and business is seen as risky. So I think, again, those sentiments really reinforce the messages coming through in our report.
David, what are some of the big changes that would make things easier for you?
I think you know, we've got to look at these compliances reporting structures. And really think about, you know, what level of reporting and compliance sits within what level of business. Because if, you know, at the moment, you know, someone with one employee, two employees, has still got the same level of compliance as someone with 200 employees. And perspective, right? So I think maybe there's some opportunity around saying, look, if these are some different thresholds, and if you're under those thresholds and you're reporting requirements may be slightly different to a business that's, you know, over the threshold, for example. I don't have that solution, but I think what's happened is we can't continue down the path of letting legislators just add more legislation year after year after year.
So, Melinda, you've published this report briefly. What's the next step to help people like David stay in the game?
Look, we are obviously going to be advocating, and we have been for some time, really, on this point about regulation. And I think one of the things that's been lost is, you know, regulation has an important role to play, of course, and it can be helpful to small businesses in being really clear about what you need to do to start up and the like. But as David said, it's the compliance cost that's really grown out of hand, and we need to really lean into that. And I think sitting alongside of that is a conversation about what is the real risk. And I think that's been lost. And so there are processes that we need to sharpen in terms of how legislation is created. And we absolutely have to start getting moving on that, because there's a real opportunity cost. I guess the final thing that is a message that's come through from your callers is that, you know, people are seeing the return on work and education. They're really questioning what that is now, and that's a message that we hear more broadly. So that leans us into a tax conversation as well. So they're issues that are front and centre on our agenda.
Melinda, David, thank you both so much. Melinda Salento is the CEO of the Committee for the Economic Development of Australia. David Ridden, the founder and CEO of Grandad Jack's Craft Distillery and president of the Australian Distillers Association. You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. Well, Well, you heard earlier about the outbreak of the parasitic varroa mite and how it's wreaking havoc with European honeybees, which has devastating effects on commercial beekeepers, obviously, but also on the tens of thousands of amateur backyard beekeepers in Australia. And so I spoke to Mike Allerton, who's the Vice President of the Amateur Beekeepers Australia Group, and here's what he had to say about the emotional impact of losing his hives to varroa mite.
Well, like a lot of backyard beekeepers, I viewed my bees as family members. You mentioned that earlier. And a lot of beekeepers treat their bees as their kids. So it was devastating. It was really hard to take. But worse than that was during the eradication phase. And I volunteered to take part in that with the hope that it would work. And the number of beekeepers that had to see their hives destroyed in front of them, even though at the time they didn't have any mites, that was really devastating for a lot. And there were people on the commercial side and the amateur side that were pretty much on suicide watch for quite a while there. It was just absolutely depressing and devastating.
Mike, there's a question here from, there's a comment here from Margaret from Canberra saying, in recent years, people have been encouraged to think that home beekeeping is easier than it really is. Margaret says, amateur beekeeping is quite expensive. It shouldn't be undertaken without proper training and guidance. If poorly managed, bees will struggle or swarms will leave and enlarge the problematic feral population and spread diseases to other hives. What do you say to that? Has it been a bit of a wake-up call for people who were just thinking maybe it would be a cute little weekend hobby?
I totally agree with her comment. There's been a lot of people get into beekeepers and it's a bit like the puppy for Christmas and it's too much work and they abandon. And that's unfortunate because an unmanaged hive can become the next disease bank and pest or disease, varroa now, but American foul brood is still a massive problem throughout Australia. And unmanaged hives become those AFB and mite bombs. So they definitely need training. I recommend anyone going into beekeeping, before you get your hive, go to the local club and show up there every month for a few months and learn how to do it and see if it's for you before you get your hives. And then when you're confident and you've had some training in the field days, you're on the best foot forward to do a successful beekeeping hobby.
Well, that's Mike Allerton talking to me earlier in the show. He's the Vice President of Amateur Beekeepers Australia. You can go back and listen to that whole chat by just searching for Life Matters on ABC Listen. Well, thank you so much for your texts today. A lot of you wanted to talk to me about amateur beekeeping. One says, I know two people in my area in Bellinginshire. One has lost her beehives and the other grows organic blueberries. And the yield went from 200 to 20 kilolitres, I think, this year due to the loss of bees, which is very scary. Will says European honeybees should be kept only by licensed beekeepers. They are not pets. People with allergies to bee venom can be killed by bees. Also, the bees will evolve resistance to the mite. A text from Sue, who's an amateur beekeeper outside Mullumbimby in the Northern Rivers in New South Wales, says, I have two European honey beehives and two native beehives that do an amazing job of pollinating my orchards and gardens. Fortunately, I haven't lost a beehive to varroa or to small hive beetle, another massive pest in this area. The beekeeping club I'm in provides a lot of support with field days and guest speakers, and this has helped a lot. Beekeeping has become a lot more labour intensive and expensive, but like all beekeepers, I just love my bees. I think what's happening has made people realise how important bees are. Well, that is just about it for Life Matters, coming to you today from Jagera and Turrbal land, but I will be back with you again tomorrow. We're going to talk about the draft Children's Online Privacy Code, which is trying to give kids stronger protection online, what to expect from that. Also, we're going to talk about the right to repair. You know when you buy something and it breaks and you want to fix it, but it feels like it's designed in such a way that makes that pretty much impossible? Well, there's been a recent court case in the US that's brought the idea of a right to repair back into the spotlight. I'll take a look at where that's sitting in Australia. That's all tomorrow on Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.